10 years ago, or maybe a little less, maybe 10 years ago, this was a cult. Tolkien was an absolute fad, a cult. Everybody was reading it, especially people in college. You could find signs in New York subways says Frodo lives, and T-shirts, and hobbits were very big. Like all good things, it passes. I'm surprised they're not out of print. Most good books are. But I suppose this will be in print for a long, long time. He was Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, was an Oxford Don, a professor at Oxford of languages, and a very brilliant scholar, translated all kinds of languages. Matter of fact, he wrote in several languages, too, and translated the Book of Job, interestingly enough, into French for one edition, and was an Icelandic scholar, Old English scholar, Middle English scholar, all that, and brilliant guy. He and C.S. Lewis and a couple other people were pals. They used to sit around at lunchtime and kind of read each other their work. He wrote this for his little boy, and it has since been the subject of PhD dissertations, of novels, of articles, of movie. Maybe you saw the movie, the first part. Unfortunately, in my opinion, Disney didn't do the movie. It was done by somebody else. And the anybody see it? No? The animation was interesting and brilliant in some spots, but I loved the early Disney stuff, not the later Disney stuff. They cut down so much on the animation, the drawings, but the early Disney's like Snow White and Bambi, and all those are nothing better. This is the story for those, maybe I ought to take a show of hands. Is there anybody who's never read it? All right, because I don't want to say something that everybody knows, and you say, gee, I didn't come to hear it. I know all that.
Can I ask you a question before you get started?
Yeah.
That was originally published when? Long before 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah. And I would have to look, I think, about 1939, even a little more before that.
Not the turn of the century,
I think. No. It seems to me it was back around, I don't know. Let me look. This doesn't say the first one, but it's back late 30s or early 40s. Yeah, he hasn't been dead too long. He was a very, just another word about him, he's a very quiet guy, Oxford Don and all that, and didn't have any notoriety, didn't particularly want any, and all of a sudden he wrote this book and it turned into this cult thing, and then it made him $1 million. So promptly he had to give up his anonymity and move, because people were, as Ernie Zorb, the old woodcutter up here, used to say, that people were falling into a soup. For Ernie, anybody more than one per 10 miles was too many. And so he had to move, and then people would come to England to talk to him and write books, and they would tramp through his garden and mash his petunias. And he finally said, I don't know if it's worth it having $1 million. Well, I think that's probably open to debate, but that's what people say who have $1 million. They're not sure it's worth it. You ever notice that? People say money's not everything. It's something. All right, this story, for those of you who haven't read it, very briefly, is a story of a quest. You know, there's all kinds of quests. Primarily the big one, Ulysses, right? Jason and the Golden Fleece, where you have to go do something, you have to bring something back. A dangerous journey. Like Ulysses took him 10 years to get back to Ithaca from Troy, the fall of Troy, after all those poor people sailed over there just to revenge the abduction of Helen by Paris. I think they should have left her. It turned into a great novel, but it seemed to me a lot of work for that kind of a thing. That's the big quest. Ulysses, Hector, all the big guys, strong, brawny, although Ulysses was short, squat, and bow-legged, but he was big in heart and a mighty wielder of sword and all that. And you expect these things in these kinds of people. Ulysses had a hard time, of course. It took him 10 years to get back, and every now and then he was washed ashore on some other island where he would have to stay with the princess of the island. It was hard times. But he made do. And 10 years later, he finally got back to his wife, and she looked at her watch and said, it's about time. But that's another story. I'll save that one for another day. It's a great story when he finally comes back. She says, "Where the hell have you been?" But anyway, he didn't say it quite like that. This is close. RSV. So anyway, that's the epic kind of thing. MGM, cast of thousands. Camels and horses and chariots all over the stage. Then there's the folk epic. That's about the little people. The fairy tale. And there's always two or three sons or three daughters, right? And there's something to be done, and it's always the youngest son who gets the... Like the king will come and say, we've got to rid this land of something. Who wants to do it? And the two older brothers take one step back. And there's the young one sitting out there with his yo-yo and looking around. There's nobody around. And he gets the job. And he does it, right? He does a good job. He marries the princess. The spell is lifted. The land is healed. All these are very mythic things that go back into our, Jung would say, our collective unconscious. The idea of the regreening of the land and the water coming and crops growing and all that kind of thing. It's all tied into this. So we have little people. Hobbits are little guys. I might as well stop talking and just read you some of this stuff. I think that's enough by way of introduction. Here's what hobbits look like. And if you're very careful, you can see them around here, because I've got some slides that I'm going to show Tuesday, I guess, of a hobbit thing in Holden, believe it or not. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today. So there you are. They're not as many, so if you haven't seen them, that's probably why. For they love peace and quiet and good tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favorite haunt. They do not and did not understand or like machines more complicated than a forge bellows, a water mill, or a hand loom, though they were skillful with tools. Even in ancient days, they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk, as they call us, and now they avoid us with dismay and are becoming hard to find. More proof. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft in their movements. Now, they are hard to find, and you don't see as many as you used to, but you'd think you would, because they dressed in bright colors, being notably fond of yellow and green. But they seldom wore shoes, since their feet had tough leathery soles, and were clad in thick curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which was commonly brown. Their faces were, as a rule, good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat and drank often and heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times, and of six meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties and in presents, which they gave away freely and eagerly accepting. So you see, we're dealing with really nice folks here. They like nothing better than a pint of beer after a hard day's work. They like to smoke pipeweed. And have six meals a day when they could get them, and sit around. The last thing hobbits wanted to do would go on adventures. They were not interested in adventures. In fact, any hobbit who was caught or suspected of having an adventure was suspect. And there's the early book called The Hobbit is about Bilbo, kind of one of the leaders, the patriarchs of the clan. He does have an adventure. He goes off and comes back staggeringly rich. He finds a big dragon, interestingly enough, named Smaug, and takes his hoard of jewels and stuff and brings back on with several ponies laden with chests of gold and jewels and all that. And everybody from that time on says, "I think he had an adventure." And he's always kind of suspect. It's kind of like being on the periphery of the Missouri Synod. The loose leaf section. Take you in and out very fast. Mostly out. Okay, so that's what hobbits are. Now, what's the adventure is about, in when you go on an adventure, it's usually to bring to something back, like Jason, the Golden Fleece, Ulysses, they were all supposed to bring back Helen, and you're supposed to do that. This is a reverse quest in that you're trying to give something away, trying to lose something, and that something is the ring. It's the magic ring, which was forged in I can't think of a word. That's great. Volcano. Thank you, me. You're welcome. Forged in a volcano by evil. Now, another thing that is in keeping with the true sense of the quest, everything is fairly simple. Not simplistic, but simple. There's good and identifiable as such, and evil. The good guys, in this case, are the hobbits and Gandalf, the wizard, The bad guy is Sauron and his minions. And so you got these people lined up, and you're one or the other. Okay, so the ring has been created by Sauron, and it's an evil ring. It's something like this one that I wear in my hand. And when you put it on, you disappear. And that's kind of neat. You can run around scaring people because you're invisible. On the other hand, it makes you very visible to the other evil people around because they can see you better. Sauron made a bunch of these rings and then gathered the kings and princes of the land around him and said, "Hey, would you like a little ring?" And they would put them on, and immediately they would be enslaved to him. So that was the whole idea of Sauron, is to enslave the world. And Gandalf, this very powerful and very ancient wizard, understands what's going on, and there's one ring. He made nine, and one ring was Sauron's. With that one, when he put that one on, all the other guys who had the rings were under his power, right? And the ring got lost. There's a long story about that, which you can read about in the book. But at any rate, it came in the possession of another hobbit, and Sauron says, "Where's my ring? What did I do with that ring? I've got to get these guys." Gandalf knows he's looking for the ring. Lo and behold, it winds up in Bilbo's possession. Bilbo is now 111 years old, and he's going to go off and live with the elves. His nephew Frodo is now about 40. He says, "Frodo, the house is yours," and by house they have a little hole in the ground. They live in a little, like a rabbit warren, back up in the hill, a little hole. He says, "The house is yours, my stuff is yours, and this ring, I don't know what that's for, but I came across that years ago, and it's your ring, I'm leaving." He puts on his Kelty pack, grabs a little staff, and off he goes. And Frodo has that ring and all his other possessions. He's not interested in it, doesn't know anything about it. He leaves it there on a shelf. Gandalf, years later, shows up and says, didn't your uncle leave you a ring? Frodo says, "Yeah, I got it here somewhere," and he digs around, brings out the ring, and Gandalf says, "Let me tell you about this. This is bad news, and it's got to be destroyed." Frodo says, "Destroy a pretty ring like that?" And then Gandalf told him the story, how Sauron forged it, and he's looking for it, and if he finds it, it's all over, folks. So he said, "Well, let's destroy it." You try to break it, you can't break it. He throws it in the fire, it won't melt. The only place it can be destroyed is drop it back in the volcano in which it was forged. And Frodo says, "All right, take it. Where is it?" And he said, "Well, it's about 1,800 miles away. You know, they don't have trams or subways and BART systems, and you got to walk." So that's how far we're talking about in the journey. And Frodo says, "Who do you think's going to take it?" And everybody backs up that 2 feet. The wizard stands and looks at Frodo, waiting for the shock of recognition. So Frodo decides he will take the ring. Okay, so they're off on their journey. And there's a nice little section where, his faithful gardener, Samwise, is standing outside clipping the hedge listening to this. Clip, 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 and old Gandalf kind of reaches out the window and snatches him up and says, "I should turn you into a toad for listening, my friend. But instead, I'll send you with him. That'll be your punishment." So off they go. And here's a nice little section. They're walking. It's like you'd head for Lyman. You get up there and you can look back. And you can see where, in fact, you know, you can see the tailings for a long ways. And then even after, when you're Lyman, you can tell where Holden is because you can see the valley and where it turns to the right. So that, pretend you're down that far. A mile or two further south, they hastily crossed the great road from the Brandywine Bridge. They were now in the Tookland, and bending southeastwards, they made for the Green Hill Country. As they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps of Hobbiton far off, twinkling in the gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land. It was followed by Bywater beside its gray pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. "I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again," he said quietly. So with that, where the journey really begins. And Tolkien has this nice, gentle way not schmaltz, but sentimentality handled very nicely. And you know that somehow that he's not going to look down that valley again. As a matter of fact, he does, but he's changed. That's one of the things about the quest. In fact, let me just say this really fast. I have it written down here somewhere. About 6 or 7 elements of the quest. First of all, you have to have a hero. I've talked about that. Either Jason or Odysseus or a folk hero, in this case, Frodo. Then the second thing in the quest is a long journey with an unknown destination. The third element of a quest is help from animals, if you're in a folk quest. Animals help you, like in fairy tales. The fourth one, there's an obvious good or evil. I talked about that. Fifth element of a quest, there's always an injury to the quester. He's going to get hurt somewhere. And the sixth element, the quester cannot return home. Or like Thomas Wolfe said, home, you can't go home again. If you return home, home is never the same. It's something like going to war, Korea or Vietnam, you come back and suddenly America's changed. Well, you've changed, people have changed, everything's changed. You've been wounded psychically, physically, whatever, and home just ain't the same. And then the seventh and last element of the quest is that the friends who aided you in your journey one by one drop away, fall away. Either they quit, they get killed, they have their own adventure, until finally the quester is right out there at the edge all by himself. In American literature, a good example of a quest, a type of quest, would be the Leatherstocking Tales, if you remember those from James Fenimore Cooper. Leatherstocking, Natty Bumpo was his name, he was always out on the edge of the frontier with his rifle and his two Indians, Chingachgook and Uncas, the last of the Mohicans, remember? Carl Sandburg called him Chicago and Uncle because he couldn't pronounce it. Now, one of the things Tolkien does better maybe than any writer that I know, he has a great facility for names. When he names things, they're always exactly the right names. He names mountains, he names rivers, he names waterfalls, he names people, and the names are beautiful. Listen to this small paragraph. When they had walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool, and starry, but smoke-like wisps of mist were creeping up from the hillsides, from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches, swaying in a light wind above their heads, made a black net against the pale sky. They ate a very frugal supper for hobbits, and then went on again. Soon they struck a narrow road that went rolling up and down, fading into darkness ahead. Listen to these names. The road to Woodhall and Stock and the Buckleberry Ferry. It climbed away from the main road in the water valley and wound over the skirts of the green hills towards Woody End, a wild corner of the East Farthing. It's beautiful names. If you like language, if you like the sound of words, Tolkien is for you because of those great ability to name things. I've always wanted to see, when you go on a hike, you do see those things. East Farthing, it could be Misty Meadows or wherever. The golf course, as the bear hunters call it. If you have any questions as we go along, be sure and raise your hand, or just shout out. I don't see your hand, and ask a question. Okay, on the road, they're on. Frodo and Sam and a couple other hobbits are going along, tagging along, and naturally they can't get from here to there unhindered. The Black Riders are on the trail, folks. The Black Riders are these princes, these kings, who have come under the sway of the Dark Lord by his ring. And they're invisible. They have no body, but they have kind of a cloak they wear that kind of hovers around this air or flame. And they ride these dark horses, and they get word that the ring that the boss is looking for is in Hobbiton. So they go to Hobbiton, look for the hobbit. He's not there, and they set out on the road to find him. So with that in mind, they hear something, the little hobbits got their little kelties on, and they hear something, a horse coming. And Frodo has been warned by Gandalf, if you hear anything strange in the road, dive under a tree. Don't wait around, because maybe something bad. Like Satchel Paige, the old black pitcher, remember, his philosophy in life was never look back. Something might be gaining on you. The other two ran quickly to the left and down into a little hollow not far from the road. There they lay flat. Frodo hesitated for a second. Curiosity or some other feeling was struggling with his desire to hide. The sound of hoofs drew nearer. Just in time, he threw himself down in a patch of long grass behind a tree that overshadowed the road. Then he lifted his head and peered cautiously above one of the great roots. Round the corner came a black horse, no hobbit pony, but a full-sized horse, and on it sat a large man who seemed to crouch in the saddle wrapped in a great black cloak and hood, so that only his boots and the high stirrups showed below. His face was shadowed and invisible. When it reached the tree and was level with Frodo, the horse stopped. The riding figure sat quite still with its head bowed, as if listening. From inside the hood came a noise as of someone sniffing to catch an elusive scent. The head turned from side to side of the road. Frodo's lying down in the weeds watching this guy, and he has this uncontrollable desire to take the ring and slip it on because he knows it'll make him invisible. Now, the ring has a great power of its own. It kind of almost wants somebody to put it on. It kind of commands you to do that. because even from a distance, the ring is being called by Sauron and says, get this guy. Make him put it on. And as soon as he puts it on, of course, he would be visible to the Dark Rider. Instead, he realizes that, and he doesn't, and the thing sniffs and goes on. Now, this is an interesting bit of writer's technique here. Frodo crawled to the edge of the road and watched the rider until he dwindled into the distance. He could not be quite sure, but it seemed to him that suddenly, before it passed out of sight, the horse turned aside and went into the trees on the right. See what that does? That sets up the next episode. If he had gone out of sight completely, but turning aside, it gives that expectation of, if we go down far enough, that's where he's going to be waiting for us to jump right out. That's an easy kind of thing to do, but it's a writer's technique. It's kind of formula writing, but in Tolkien's case, it's brilliantly done. So off they go, and they go through all sorts of adventures. And they run into, they go into the dark forest and get tangled up in trees, and the old forest just comes alive, and the tree grabs Merry, one of the little, they're Merry and Pippin, two of the little hobbits, and just kind of grabs him. And they're really in bad trouble. All of a sudden, here comes this singing that is heard from the hills. And Tom Bombadil comes dancing along in bright yellow pants and big beard and bright blue twinkling eyes like periwinkles and green shirt and red boots. Really colorful guy. He's dancing along. He is the master of this particular part of the forest. And he tells the old willow to let Merry go. And he invites the hobbits into his house for supper. They're tired of trail mix, so they're going to have some good stuff here. And oh, lo and behold, right in the middle of the forest, they walk into the house. It says, they were in a low room filled with light of lamps swinging from the beams of the roof. And on the table of dark polished wood stood many candles, tall and yellow, burning brightly. In a chair at the far side of the room, facing the outer door, sat a woman. Her long yellow hair rippled down her shoulders. Her gown was green, green as young reeds, shot with silver like beads of dew. And her belt was of gold, shaped like a chain of flag lilies, set with pale blue eyes of forget-me-nots. About her feet in wide vessels of green and brown earthenware, white water lilies were floating, so that she seemed to be enthroned in the midst of a pool. Wow, what a woman. That's Goldberry. That's Bombadil's lady. Goldberry is her name. Enter, good guest, she said, and as she spoke, they knew that it was her clear voice they had heard singing. They came a few timid steps further into the room and began to bow low, feeling strangely surprised and awkward, like folk that, knocking at a cottage door to beg for a drink of water, have been answered by a fair young elf queen clad in living flowers. Now, these guys are great. The hobbits are very polite, and they're always bowing, scraping, and tugging at their forelock and tipping their hat and kind of aw shucks around. They're not arrogant, they're not bold, they're always a little bit bashful, which makes them kind of nice. The world is filled with too much arrogance. Anyway, these hobbits are just right. So they are entertained by Tom Bombadil, and if you can imagine this Goldberry sitting in the middle of the earthenware pots floating with water lilies. It's a wild sight. I'd love to see somebody doing that, whole court that way. And off they go to the next destination, the town of Bree, the Dancing Pony Inn. That's where the snack bar gets its name, the Dancing Pony or Prancing Pony. That's the snack. That's where that comes from this novel. And that's where they meet their next companion called Strider. And let me introduce you to Strider. He's a man. He's not a hobbit. Suddenly, Frodo noticed that a strange-looking, weather-beaten man sitting in the shadows near the wall was also listening intently to the hobbit talk. He had a tall tankard in front of him and was smoking a long-stemmed pipe, curiously carved. His legs were stretched out before him, showing high boots of supple leather that fitted him well, but had seen much wear and were now caked with mud. A travel-stained cloak of heavy dark green cloth was drawn close about him, and in spite of the heat of the room, he wore a hood that overshadowed his face, but the gleam of his eyes could be seen as he watched the hobbits. "Who is that?" Frodo asked when he got a chance to whisper to Mr. Butterbur, the landlord. "I don't think you introduced him." "Him," said the landlord. "I don't rightly know. He's one of the wandering folk. Rangers, we call him." So this is Strider. Strider is a tall Gary Cooper type with this weather stain. He doesn't even use insulite. He just takes his cloak and down he goes. That's all he needs. And come to find out, he is one of the very, very fine guys. And as the tale unfolds, we learn that Strider is really Prince Aragorn, Prince of Gondor, a huge city, country, way out yonder, several leagues, 100 leagues away. But he's disguised as a ranger, and it's his job, along with a bunch of other rangers, to kind of run around the hills, just like people were up on Buckskin and down Lyman and up around Martin's Ridge, making sure that all of us in Holden Village were safe. Maybe that's what angels are called, striders, rangers. Okay, so he meets Strider, and off they go on their adventure. And their first stop after that would be to go to Rivendell. Rivendell is where the elves live, and that's where they're going to get more food. And they have two settings there 3 times a day at Rivendell. And you can really pork it up a little bit. And they have meat and dessert there, too. And they replenish themselves, they refresh themselves. And there's a big council held there. And all the people, there are a couple of men there. There's elves there. There are dwarves. A lot of different folk of the forest are there and having a big council because they know times are bad and the evil is about to overrun the land. And they say, what are we going to do? And they say, I understand there's one among us who has the ring. And once again, they all take 2 steps backward and there's Frodo. So he gets the commission. It's his call. And they say, you are now anointed. Go and do that thing. Get rid of that ring and don't talk to us. Anybody who's with you is dangerous. So that's where there's a company of 9 people are chosen. Aragorn, the prince, a man named Boromir, and then there's an elf, Legolas, who's a little taller than a hobbit, keen of eye, can see about 5 miles on a shot. Gimli, the dwarf, who's got a nice little axe, loves to hew orcs. And orc is a great name, and orc is the evil in the book. It's a kind of a half man, half gorilla, half hybrid of some kind. Long arms, knuckles, and hairy knuckles that go on the ground like an ape, and big slantern jaw. Looks like one of the Mavericks we used to have around here. He wears a studded belt and has a shield and just really mean. And he likes to take those heads right off of those guys. And there's Merry and Pippin, the hobbits, and Gandalf the wizard, and of course Frodo and Sam. So there's 9 people. And as the tale unfolds, and it's 3 volumes, by the way, this thing is longer than War and Peace. It reads a lot faster than Tolstoy, but it's a few more pages than Tolstoy. One by one, they get captured, they are killed, or whatever. They have their own adventures. In this regard, he's not unlike Dickens, who will have his characters go off in a myriad of ways, and then the last 50 pages of something like Bleak House, he pulls the string, and all of a sudden say, oh, now I see this relation. And then you understand the entire book, whereas the first 950 pages, you say, I'll never understand what's going on. But he keeps control of all those things. That's what makes a great book, is the richness, the texture, why Dickens is so good and why Russian novelists are the best. They have character and plot and all that good stuff. Okay. This is a romance in the great tradition of romance. It's a singing novel. At the drop of a hat, these people will stand up and declaim. They will recite a poem in the midst of danger. Aragorn will stand up and say, I'm reminded of this, and he'll stand up and he'll sing this 15-verse epic thing. And all around are the bad guys looking for him. And they were very careful not to leave any tracks. They go, you know, they walk down the middle of the stream. When they have to walk, they take brush. And then he stands up and sings. And then they light a fire. There's some humor in here. You can't take it all that seriously. In fact, I think it's if it's better. In fact, Aragorn says, and they're up on this top of this little dell, make camp, and they know the Black Riders are following. He says, I was too careless on the hilltop, answered Strider. I was very anxious to find some sign of Gandalf, but it was a mistake for 3 of us to go up and stand there so long. For the black horses can see, and the riders can use men and other creatures as spies, as we found at Bree. They themselves do not see the world of light as we do, but our shapes cast shadows in their minds, which only the noon sun destroys. So with that, they all hunker down and say, oh, we better be quiet. And the next thing, Aragorn stands up and sings. So that draws the Black Riders right to him. Did you see anything? Asked Frodo, springing to his feet.
"No, sir, I saw nothing, but I didn't stop to look." "I saw something," said Mary, "or I thought I did, away westward where the moonlight was falling on the flats beyond the shadow of the hilltops. I thought there were two or three black shapes. They seemed to be moving this way." "Keep close to the fire with your faces outward," cried Strider. "Get some of the longer sticks ready in your hands." This is another nice touch. Here we know these guys they're black riders. They have infinite power. They're invisible. They're evil. They got daggers. And Strider says, "Pick up some long sticks." That's not going to go far against these guys, but I guess that's all you have. There's no bazookas around. For a breathless time, they sat there, silent and alert, with their backs turned to the wood fire, each gazing into the shadows that encircled them. Nothing happened. There was no sound or movement in the night. Frodo stirred, feeling he must break the silence. He longed to shout out loud. "Hush," whispered Strider. "What's that?" gasped Pippin the same moment. Over the lip of the little dell, on the side away from the hill, they felt, rather than saw, a shadow rise. One shadow.
They strained their eyes, and the shadow seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope, looking down on them. So black were they, they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as of venomous breath and felt a thin, piercing chill from the shape slowly advance. There's another nice writer's technique on Tolkien's part. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope looking down at them. They didn't just come crashing up and dive right into them. It's the technique of coming up, slow down, to stop action, and just think about it, right? Yeah.
To me, that's where they got the idea
for Darth Vader. No, very likely. Yeah, these are Darth Vader type. That's right. Terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. Now, these hobbits are doing it all the time. They get frightened, they whack, they hit the ground. Get those long sticks, and then they fall flat on the ground. Frodo was hardly less terrified than his companions. He was quaking as if bitter with cold. And what does he do? He takes the ring, it's overpowering, it's on his neck and the string, and he slips it on his finger. And he becomes invisible. The minute he did that, they could see him exactly, because he's now invisible. And he could see them. Their shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of the dell, three advancing, and their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helms of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell on him and pierced him as they rushed towards him. Desperately, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red as if it was a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long and gleaming, and on his helm was a crown. In one hand he held a knife, a long sword, and the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. At that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground. And he heard himself crying aloud, "Oh, Elbereth Cathoniel!" Which is Dan the Torpedo's full speed ahead in Elvish. At the same time, he struck at the foot of the enemy. A shrill cry rang out in the night, and he felt a pain like a dart of poison ice pierce his left shoulder. And he passes out. But just before he passes out, he slips the ring off his finger. So Frodo then is wounded in his shoulder by this deadly knife. Okay, and a piece of it's broken off inside of him. It's going to cause this wound that will never heal. It's a psychic wound and a physical wound too. And here's this nice romance part. There's only one thing that will heal this wound, says Aragorn. A leaf called Aethelon. Okay? Now, they're out in the middle of Lyman Lake, mind you, maybe even up a cloudy pass. He says, "These leaves," he said, "I have walked far to find, for the plant does not grow in the bare hills, but in the thickets away south of the road. I found it in the dark by the scent of its leaves." He crushed the leaf in his fingers, and it gave out a sweet and pungent fragrance. "It is fortunate that I could find it, for it is a healing plant that the men of the West brought to Middle Earth." All right, here's another one of Deus Ex Machina things. It's fortunate that here we're out in the middle of a cloudy pass or Lyman Lake or somewhere, and it's pitch black, it's at night, they just had this battle. He says, "The only thing that's going to heal this fellow is this leaf. I can smell it now." And off he goes, crashing, bullswhacking down the hill, and he doesn't come back with it. That's great. That's great romance. It's fortunate. See, even Tolkien, I think, has a tongue not crammed into his cheek when he wrote it, but it's right there because it is fortunate. Yes, it is fortunate. It's Deus Ex Machina. That's all you can say about it. Machine of the Gods. an old Greek thing. When the Greek, in those tragedies, if a person was flashing around with a sword and he was really getting in bad trouble and the bad guys were just about to overcome him and he had no place to go and the stage was right there, and the playwright definitely said, how do I get him out of this? It's not like being a bad playwright, it's the fact that you're Greek and you believe the intervention, direct intervention of the gods, which we don't except on Sundays, maybe, but any time the Greek gods were allowed to do it. And all of a sudden the guy up there in a little window over the proscenium would drop a rope or some kind of a hoist, and the good guy would grab that and be jerked to safety, and the crowd would cheer. Now we look upon that as bad writing. A Deus Ex Machina of the Gods in our tradition would be like a B or C Western, with Tess too hard and just plain Darius are tied up to a tree out in the middle of the desert, and the Apaches are circling about to do an end. At the last possible second, the cavalry comes over from this little pimple of a hill way over there. There's 18,000 John Wayne come and rescue him. Well, it's unlikely that they would be over there. That's the Machine of the Gods done badly. Anyway, that's what this is. It's kind of funny, and it's neat, though, at the same time. Okay. You have any questions? Comments? Yeah, he wrote it for his son, that's right. Yeah, I'm trying to find some language here. Oh, here it is. There's a bunch of battles. C.B. DeMille should have filmed this because there are battles. If your thing is battles and epic and there's a love thing, love story, that's what I'm going to show the slide maybe Tuesday. It's a beautiful... I shouldn't tell you if you haven't read it. There's a great wedding between Aragorn, and he finally gets his true love in the end. And does she have a name? Arwen Evenstar. Oh, is that Arwen Evenstar? Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I did, yeah. I was just kind of saying, well, too bad Disney didn't do it, instead of United Artists. But anyway, it's on the film. But I've got pictures, a slide of the wedding and Aragorn and all that kind of stuff. Yes, I do. It was hard to find. A lot of them were taken up in the miners' village and up on the tailings, and the wedding took place right out here by the jacuzzi. Maybe I did. Well, there's a place. anyway, get it back there. The language again. They're in a big battle, and we've got to retreat into this huge canyon, an arroyo, a barranca, we would call it in Southern California, but it's bigger than that. It's like a canyon. All right, it's called Helm's Deep. Listen to this language. This is just magnificent. At Helm's Gate, below the mouth of the deep, there was a heel of rock just outward by the northern cliff. There upon its spur stood high walls of ancient stone, and within them was a lofty tower. Men said that in the far-off days of the glory of Gondor, the two kings had built here this fastness for the hands of giants. The Hornburg, it was called, for a trumpet sounded upon the tower echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing the war from the caves beneath the hills. Wasn't that Old Testament, Ecclesiastes, and Melville? A wall, this is the good stuff, a wall, too, the men of the old had made in the Hornburg, to the southern cliff, barring the entrance to the gorge. Beneath it, by a wide culvert, the deeping stream passed out. About the feet of the horn rock it wound, and flowed then into a gully through a midst of a wide green gorge, sloping gently down from Helm's Gate to Helm's Dyke. Thence it fell into the deeping coombe, and out into the Westfold Vale. There in the Hornburg at Helm's Gate, Eckenbrand, master of Westfold and the borders of the marsh, now dwelt. Oh, magnificent. She's going to cheer.
I love it.
You can see it, yeah. Oh, yeah. Fantastic name. Nobody has names better. So they have another big battle. And I could reach it, it would take 3 days to read all this stuff. Legolas, the elf, is trying to get... See, elves and dwarves don't like each other. They're always enmity between them, traditionally. But these guys are forced together to do battle against the real bad guys. And like most people, you find out the neighbor's not so bad when you get to know him anyway. It's a little strange if you're not in Minnesota, but you can tolerate him. So Legolas keeps trying to get Gimli to say, you've got to come back with me to the forest. And Gimli, being a dwarf, lives in caves. He says, well, you've got to see my cave. They're always back and forth drawing each other. They say, where do you see my tree? Or where do you see my whatever? And Gimli says, where do you see my cave? There are columns of white and saffron and dawn rose. Legolas fluted and twisted into dreamlike forms. They spring up many-colored floors to meet the glistening pendants of the roof. Wings, rope, curtains, fine as frozen clouds, spears, banners, pinnacles of suspended palaces. Still lakes mirror them. A glimmering world looks up in the dark pools, covered with clear glass cities, such as the mind of Durin could scarce have imagined in his sleep, stretched on through avenues and pillared courts, on into the duke's recesses where no light can come. And on and on and on. There's no way I'm going to be able to get through with all this because there's so much and they'll line up in a hot day. But there is one other section that I'd like to read you. They're getting close. He's walked almost from Los Angeles to St. Louis to drop this ring. And Gollum, the evil hobbit, nasty little thing, and he's leading the hobbits up to this path. And he wants the ring back. He's the guy who came. He strangled the guy for it. It was a long story, but the ring was lost, and Gollum was a hobbit, and he and his cousin were fishing. And his cousin saw something glittering on the bottom of the river. He dived and came up with it. And Gollum said, what have you got there, cousin? And he said, oh, it's a nice ring. And Gollum says, give it to him. And he's a royal pronoun. And he says, no, it's mine. He got strangled. He said, now I have it. He called it precious. My precious. And all the way through the book, he says, my precious. And he loses it. And he goes crazy, absolutely bonkers, because he wants this ring back. So he's leading Frodo through this path, saying, this is the way. And knowing all along, inside the path, is Shelob, this huge, fat, bulbous spider, about as big around as this spider thing. Okay. Down the face of the precipice, sheer and almost smooth, it seemed in the pale moonlight, a small black shape was moving. No, that's not. That's Gollum. You got to get to Shelob. 425. Chris Jack talking to nobody in particular. Okay, here we are. Most like a spider she was, but huger than the great hunting beast, and more terrible than they because of the evil purpose in her remorseless eyes. Those same eyes that he had thought daunted and defeated. There they were, lit with a fell light again. By the way, there's another Tolkienism. Yeah, he loved the word fell, awesome or terrible. We don't use that word anymore, fell, or like fey, as in crazy horse. It's crazy meaning fey, light, airy, and all that. Anyway, great horns she had, and behind her short, stock-like neck was a huge, swollen body, a vast, bloated bag swaying and sagging between her legs. Its great bulk was black, blotched with livid marks, but the belly underneath was pale and luminous and gave forth a stench. Her legs were bent with great knob joints high above her back, and hair that stuck out like steel spikes, and at each leg's end there was a claw. As soon as she had squeezed her soft, squelching body and folded limbs out of the upper exit from the lair, she moved with a horrible speed, now running on her creaking legs, now making a sudden bound. What a great description of that thing. Okay. I think I've got to just kind of tell you, I'm not going to tell you the ending of the story, obviously, but there's a great battle fought. The ring does indeed get dropped into the volcano, but in a way that we don't look for, in a way you don't expect, and so I won't spoil that for you because it's really kind of neat what happens there. It was prophesied by Gandalf that Gollum was going to play a very important part, and he does. So then that's done. And then on the way, Merry and Pippin, who have grown a little, they've had so many adventures that now that not only have they had adventures, which is anathema for a hobbit, they are actually taller than they're supposed to be. So they really look upon them. They are starting to work for a king here and a king in there, so they are now knights of various realms. Aragorn is marrying Arwen Evenstar, and Frodo and Sam, good old Sam the gardener, they put their kelties back on, and they say, well, let's go back to Hobbiton. And we're finally, our job's done. Well, while they've gone on this epic journey, the bad guys have invaded Hobbiton, and they've cut down the trees, the village center's a mess, the jacuzzi's got baby oil in it, everything's gone to pot, and it's a mess. So they get back and they say,
I've got to do it all over again. Get out new salt licks for the deer and cut the grass and all that kind of stuff. So there's that to look forward to. And just when you think it's the end, the last chapter, one of the last chapters is called The Cleansing of the Shire. And it's really neat because Tolkien knows people like a good ending. It's one of those things where the hobbits are nice, timid little pipe-smoking, beer-drinking little people with 6 meals a day. And these big men have come in and just mucked it up. Now, Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin have come back after 2 years of adventures, and they're tough, and they're hard, and they're lean, and they're not about to be afraid of mere men after dealing with dragons and Sauron. And do they clean up the Shire? It's a great chapter because these men see these four hobbits coming down with their kelpies and their stained cloaks, and they say, look at these hobbits. And the hobbits just keep coming and keep walking, and I won't tell you what happens, but you can guess. They really do a job on them. So it's a great book. It's a great free book. It comes boxed up in a nice little paperback set, and you can start reading The Hobbit if you want to. I would suggest, though, if you haven't read it, so you don't read The Hobbit, you start right off with The Fellowship of the Ring. And when you're all through with that, then go back and read The Hobbit. The Hobbit was written sometime before this, The Fellowship of the Ring, and it's written a little bit easier language and a little bit more childlike in its ambiance, I think. So I think you would enjoy this more and then go back and read The Hobbit. So you don't need The Hobbit to get into this. Everything that happens to The Hobbit is summarized in the first two chapters anyway. So if you haven't ever read it, I would start with Fellowship of the Ring, volumes 1, 2, and 3. And because I started to read The Hobbit about a decade ago, and I read the first 20 pages and put it down. I thought, well, this is for kids. And then a couple of years later, I picked this up. I was teaching at the University of Nebraska while I was doing graduate work back there, and I was teaching freshmen, and I'd say to them, and there's so many characters, that's why it's Dickensian, Russian, now there's so much going on. And I would say something, and there was a hand go up in the back, say, no, that's not right, this person did that. And I'd look, oh, thanks. And I would go on, and he'd have a hand again. No, it was 1842 or whatever. I said, thank you. And pretty soon his hand was going on. I said, did I make it? He said, yeah. I said, come up here. So after class, I said, have you read this? It was obvious. He said, yes, 18 times. I said, 18 times? So for the rest of the quarter, he sat on the desk beside me, and we kind of teamed. I would look at him. I would say something, and I would look at him like, is that okay? Not only does he write this epic novel, he creates three languages. There's a complete elf language. There's a complete language of human, the common speech, the Western tongue, the hobbits. Everything, and he has dates in the back of the last volume. He has about 50 or 100 pages of dates of history. Everything is, it's a complete world, a complete cosmology is developed. So if you think the story is excellent, which it is, wait till you see the whole history that goes. You don't even know, you have to know about that to enjoy the story. But it's overawing what this man has done. He's created a whole world. He's peopled it with all kinds of people, given them their own language, their own history, their own dates. And it's just a tremendous work. And if you haven't read it, do. And if you haven't read it in a long time, Holden would be a great place to start. Yeah.
Have you read Silmarillion?
I started Silmarillion and didn't quite make it through. Silmarillion was published posthumously, and it's really historical, and it's not as narrative-like as this, so I haven't quite made it through it. Yeah, there's all kinds of essays about that. The Sauron with Hitler and the War of the Rings with the First World War and on. You can find allegory coming out your ears in there. Tolkien says, no, it's not. Now, critics, being what they are, say, well, that's, you know. If you're a Freudian, you say, well, it's unconscious anyway, and it's probably come across because of premature potty training, and so we'll know what it's all about. He says, I'm telling you, it's just a story for my kids. But you read it, see what you think. Anyway, that's it. Thank you. Thank you.